There was a wise man on our hill who found his way to work his will. He changed his shape, he changed his name, but ever the other will be the same. So runs the water away, away, so runs the water away. One winter afternoon, on the shore of the Onava River, where it fingers out into the north bight of the great bay of Havnor, a man stood up on the muddy sand. A man poorly dressed and poorly shod, a thin brown man with dark eyes and hair so fine and thick it shed the rain. It was raining on the low beaches of the river mouth, the fine, cold, dismal rain of that gray winter. His clothes were soaked. He hunched his shoulders, turned about, and set off towards a wisp of chimney smoke he saw far down the shore. Behind him were the tracks of an otter's 4 feet coming up from the water, and the tracks of a man's 2 feet going away from it. Where he went then, the songs don't tell. They say only that he wandered. He wandered long from land to land. If he went along the coast of the Great Isle, in many of those villages he might have found a midwife or a wise woman or a sorcerer who knew the sign of the hand and would help him. But with Hound on his track, most likely he left Havnor as soon as he could, shipping as a crewman on a fishing boat of the Abavnor Straits or a trader of the inmost sea. On the island of Ark and in Orami on Hosk and down among the 90 isles, there are tales about a man who came seeking for Mored's Isle, where people remembered the justice of the kings and the honor of wizards. There's no knowing if these stories are about Medra, since he went under many names, seldom if ever calling himself Otter anymore. Gellick's fall had not brought Loson down. The pirate king had other wizards in his pay, among them a man called Early, who would have liked to find the young upstart who had defeated Gellick. And Early had a good chance of tracing him. Loson's power stretched all across Havnor and the north of the inmost sea, growing with the years, and the hound's nose was as keen as ever. Maybe it was to escape the hunt that Medra came to Pindor, a long way west of the inmost sea. Or maybe some rumor among the women of the hand on Hosk sent him there. Pindor was a rich island then, before the dragging came. Wherever Medra had gone until then, he had found the lands like Havnor, or worse, sunk in warfare, raids, and piracy, the fields full of weeds, the towns full of thieves. He might have thought, at first, that on Pindor he had found Mored's Isle, for the city was beautiful and peaceful and the people prosperous. He met there a mage, an old man called Hydrake, whose true name has been lost. When Hydrake heard the tale of Mored's Isle, he smiled and looked sad, and shook his head. "Not here," he said, "not this. The lords of Pindor are good men. They remember the kings. They don't seek war or plunder, but they send their sons west dragon hunting, in sport, as if the dragons of the West Reach were ducks or geese for the killing. No good will come of that." Hydrake took Medra as his student, gratefully. "I was taught my art by a mage who gave me freely all he knew. But I never found anybody to give that knowledge to until you came," he told Medra. "The young men come to me and they say, 'What good is it? Can you find gold?' they say. 'Can you teach me how to make stones into diamonds? Can you give me a sword that will kill a dragon?' What's the use of talking about the balance of things? 'There's no profit in it,' they say. 'No profit!'" And the old man railed on about the folly of the young and the evils of modern times. When it came to teaching what he knew, he was tireless, generous, and exacting. For the first time, Medra was given a vision of magic not as a set of strange gifts and reasonless crafts, but as an art which could be truly known with long study and used rightly after long practice, though even then it would never lose its strangeness. Hydrake's mastery of spells and sorcery was not much greater than his pupil's, but he had clear in his mind the idea of something very much greater, the wholeness of knowledge, and that made him a mage. Listening to him, Medra thought of how he and Anyab had walked in the dark and rain by the faint glimmer that showed them only the next step they could take, and of how they had looked up to the red ridge of the mountain in the dawn. "Every spell depends on every other spell," said Hydrake. Every motion of a single leaf moves every leaf of every tree on every isle of Earthsea. There is a pattern. That's what you must look for and look to. Nothing goes right but as part of the pattern. Only in it is freedom. Medra stayed a year or more with Hydrake, and when the old mage died, the Lord of Pendor asked Medra to take his place. Despite his ranting and scolding against dragon hunters, Hydrake had been honored in his island, and his successor would have both honor and power. Perhaps tempted to think that he had come as near to Morid's isle as he would ever come, Medra stayed a while longer on in Pendor. He went out with the young lord in his ship, past the Toring Gates and far into the West Reach to look for dragons. There was a great longing in his heart to see a dragon. But untimely storms, the evil weather of those years, drove their ship back to Ingot 3 times, and Medra refused to run her west again into those gales. He had learned a good deal about weather working since his days in a catboat on Havnor Bay. A while after that, he left Pendor, drawn southward again, and maybe went to Ensmer. In one guise or another, he came at last to Gaeath in the 90 Isles. There they fished for whales, as they still do. That was a trade he wanted no part of. Their ships stank and their town stank. He disliked going aboard a slave ship, but the only vessel going out of Gaeath to the east was a galley carrying whale oil to Olport. He had heard talk of the closed sea, south and east of O, where there were rich isles, little known, that traded little with the lands of the inmost sea. Maybe what he sought was there. So he went as a weather worker on the galley, which was rowed by 40 slaves. The weather was fair for once, a following wind, a blue sky lively with little white clouds, the mild sunlight of late spring. They made good way from Gaeath. Late in the afternoon, he heard the master say to the helmsman, "Keep her south tonight, so we don't raise roke." He had not heard of that island, and asked, "What's there?" "Death and desolation," said the ship's master, a short man with small, sad, knowing eyes, like a whale's. "War?" "Years back. Plague, black sorcery. The waters all round it are cursed." "Worms," said the helmsman, the master's brother. "Catch fish anywhere near Roke, and you'll find 'em thick with worms as a dead dog on a dunghill." "Do people still live there?" Medra asked. And the master said, "Witches," while his brother said, "Worm eaters." There were many such isles in the archipelago, made barren and desolate by rival wizards' blights and curses. They were evil places to come to, or even to pass, and Medra thought no more about this one. Until that night. Sleeping out on deck, with the starlight on his face, he had a simple, vivid dream. It was daylight, clouds racing across a bright sky, and across the sea he saw the sunlit curve of a high green hill. He woke with the vision still clear in his mind, knowing he had seen it 10 years before in the spell-locked barracks room at the mines of Samore. He sat up. The dark sea was so quiet that the stars were reflected here and there on the sleek lee side of the long swells. Oared galleys seldom went out of sight of land, and seldom rowed through the night, laying to in any bay or harbor. But there was no moorage on this crossing, and since the weather was settled so mild, they had put up the mast and big square sail. The ship drifted softly forward, her slave oarsmen sleeping on their benches, the freemen of her crew all asleep, but the helmsman and the lookout was dozing. The water whispered on her sides, her timbers creaked a little, a slave's chain rattled again. "They don't need a weather worker on a night like this, and they haven't paid me yet," Medra said to his conscience. He had waked from his dream with the name Roke on his mind. Why had he never heard of the isle or seen it on a chart? It might be accursed and deserted, as they said, but wouldn't it be set down on the charts? "I could fly there as a tern and be back on the ship before daylight," he said to himself, but idly. He was bound for Oport. Ruined lands were all too common, no need to fly to seek them. He made himself comfortable in his coil of cable and watched the stars. Looking west, he saw the four bright stars of the forge, low over the sea. They were a little blurred, and as he watched them, they blinked out, one by one. The faintest little sighing tremor ran over the slow, smooth swells. "Master," Medra said afoot, "wake up." "What now?" "A witch wind coming, following. Get the sail down." No wind stirred. The air was soft. The big sail hung slack. Only the western stars faded and vanished in a silent blackness that rose slowly higher. The master looked at that. "Witch wind, you say?" he asked, reluctant. Crafty men used weather as a weapon, sending hail to blight an enemy's crops, or a gale to sink his ships. And such storms, freakish and wild, might blow on far past the place they had been sent, troubling harvesters or sailors 100 miles away. "Get the sail down," Medra said, peremptory. The master yawned and cursed and began to shout commands. The crewmen roused up and slowly began to take the awkward sail in, and the oarmaster, after asking several questions of the master and Medra, began to roar at the slaves and stride among them, rousing them right and left with his knotted rope. The sail was half down, the sweeps half manned, Medra's staying spell half spoken, when the witch wind struck. It struck with one huge thunderclap out of sudden utter blackness and wild rain. The ship pitched like a horse rearing, then rolled so hard and far that the mast broke loose from his footing, though the stays held. The sail struck the water, filled, and pulled the galley right over, the great sweeps sliding in their oarlocks, the chained slaves struggling and shouting on their benches, barrels of oil breaking loose and thundering over one another, pulled her over and held her over, the deck vertical to the sea, till a huge storm wave struck and swamped her, and she sank. All the shouting and screaming of men's voices was suddenly silent. There was no noise but the roar of the rain on the sea, lessening as the freak wind passed on eastward. Through it, one white seabird beat its wings up from the black water and flew, frail and desperate, to the north. Printed on narrow sands under granite cliffs in the first light were the tracks of a bird alighting. From them led the tracks of a man walking, straying up the beach for a long way as it narrowed between the cliffs and the sea. Then the tracks ceased. Medra knew the danger of repeatedly taking any form but his own, but he was shaken and weakened by the shipwreck and the long night flight, and the gray beach led him only to the feet of sheer cliffs he could not climb. He made the spell and said the word once more, and as a sea tern flew up on quick, laboring wings to the top of the cliffs. Then, possessed by flight, he flew on over a shadowy sunrise land. Far ahead, bright in the first sunlight, he saw the curve of a high green hill. To it he flew, and on it landed, and as he touched the earth, he was a man again. He stood there for a while, bewildered. It seemed to him that it was not by his own act or decision that he had taken his own form, but that in touching this ground, this hill, he had become himself. A magic far greater than his own prevailed here. He looked about, curious and wary. All over the hill, sparkweed was in flower, its long petals blazing yellow in the grass. Children on Havnor knew that flower. They called it Sparks from the Burning of Ilion, when the dragon Orm, the Fire Lord, attacked the islands, and Aerith Akbi pursued him into the farthest west, to Celador. Tales and songs of the heroes rose up in Medra's memory as he stood there. Aerith Akbi and the heroes before him, a Akambar who drove the Kargs into the east, and Sariath, the peacemaker, and the mage Ath, and Mored, the white enchanter, the beloved king. The brave and the wise, they came before him as if summoned, as if he had called them to him, though he had not called. He saw them. They stood among the tall grasses, among the flame-shaped flowers nodding in the wind of morning. Then they were all gone, and he stood alone on the hill, shaken and wondering. I have seen the lords and kings of Earthsea, he thought, and they are only the grass that grows on this hill. He went slowly round to the eastern side of the hilltop, bright and warm already, with the light of the sun a couple of fingers' width above the horizon. Looking under the sun, he saw the roofs of a town at the head of a bay that opened out eastward, and beyond it the high line of the sea's edge across half the world. Turning west, he saw fields and pastures and roads. To the north were long green hills. In a fold of land southward, a grove of tall trees drew his gaze and held it. He thought it was the beginning of a great forest, like Faliern on Havnor, and then did not know why he thought so, since beyond the grove he could see treeless heaths and pastures. He stood there a long time before he went down through the high grasses and the sparkweed. At the foot of the hill he came into a lane. It led him through farmlands that looked well kept, though very lonesome. He looked for a lane or a path leading to the town, but there never was one that went eastward. Not a soul was in the fields, some of which were newly ploughed. No dog barked as he went by. Only at a crossroads, an old donkey, grazing a stony pasture, came over to the wooden fence and leaned his head out, craving company. Medra stopped to stroke the gray-brown, bony face. A city man, and a salt-water man, he knew little of farms and their animals, but he thought the donkey looked at him kindly. "Where am I, donkey?" he said to it. "How do I get to the town I saw?" The donkey leaned its head hard against his hand so that he would go on scratching the place just above its eyes and below its ears. When he did so, it flicked its long right ear. So, when he parted from the donkey, he took the right hand of the crossroad, though it looked as if it would lead back to the hill, and soon enough he came among houses, and then onto a street that brought him down into the town at the head of the bay. It was as strangely quiet as the farmlands, not a voice, not a face. It was difficult to feel uneasy in an ordinary-looking town on a sweet spring morning, but in such silence he must wonder if he was indeed in a plague-stricken place, or an island under a curse. He went on. Between a house and an old plum tree was a wash line, the clothes pinned on it flapping in the sunny breeze. A cat came round the corner of a garden. No abandoned starveling, but a white-pawed, well-whiskered, prosperous cat. And at last, coming down the steep little street, which here was cobbled, he heard voices. He stopped to listen, and heard nothing. He went on to the foot of the street. It opened into a small market square. People were gathered there, not many of them. They were not buying or selling. There were no booths or stalls set up. They were waiting for him. Ever since he had walked on the green hill that rose above the town and seen the bright shadows in the grass, his heart had been easy. He was expectant, full of a sense of great strangeness, but not frightened. He stood still and looked at the people who came to meet him. Three of them came forward. An old man, big and broad-chested, with bright white hair, and two women. Wizard knows wizard, and Medra knew they were women of power. He raised his hand closed in a fist, then turning it, opening it, offered it to them palm up. "Ah," said one of the women, the taller of the two, and she laughed. But she did not answer the gesture. "Tell us who you are," the white-haired man said, courteously enough, but without greeting or welcome. "Tell us how you came here." "I was born in Havnor, and trained as a shipwright and a sorcerer. I was on a ship bound from Gaeth to Oport. I was spared alone from drowning last night when a witch wind struck." He was silent then. The thought of the ship and the men in her swallowed his mind as the Black Sea had swallowed the ship. He gasped, as if coming up from drowning. "How did you come here?" "As a bird, a tern." "Is this Roke Island?" "You changed yourself?" He nodded. "Whom do you serve?" asked the shorter and younger of the women, speaking for the first time. She had a keen, hard face with long, black brows. "I have no master. What was your errand in Oport?" In Havnor, years ago, I was in servitude. Those who freed me told me about a place where there are no masters, and the rule of Sarriath is remembered, and the arts are honored. I have been looking for that place, that island, 7 years. Who told you about it? Women of the Hand. Anyone can make a fist and show a palm, said the tall woman pleasantly, but not everyone can fly to Roke, or swim, or sail, or come in any way at all. So we must ask, what brought you here? Medra did not answer all at once. Chance, he said at last, favoring long desire, not art, not knowledge. I think I've come to the place I sought, but I don't know. I think you may be the people they told me of, but I don't know. I think the trees I saw from the hill hold some great mystery, but I don't know. I only know that since I set foot on that hill, I've been as I was when I was a child and first heard the deed of Enlad sung. I am lost among wonders. The white-haired man looked at the two women. Other people had come forward, and there was some quiet talk among them. If you stayed here, what would you do? The black-browed woman asked him. I can build boats, or mend them, and sail them. I can find, above and underground. I can work weather, if you have any need of that, and I'll learn the art from any who will teach me. What do you want to learn? Asked the taller woman, in her mild voice. Now Medra felt he had been asked the question on which the rest of his life hung, for good or evil. Again he stood silent a while. He started to speak, and didn't speak, and finally spoke. I could not save one, not the one who saved me, he said. Nothing I know could have set her free. I know nothing. If you know how to be free, I beg you, teach me.
Free,
said the tall woman, and her voice cracked like a whip. Then she looked at her companions, and after a while she smiled a little. Turning back to Medra, she said, We're prisoners, and so freedom is a thing we study. You came here through the walls of our prison. Seeking freedom, you say. But you should know that leaving Roke may be even harder than coming to it. Prison within prison, and some we have built ourselves. She looked at the others. What do you say? She asked them. They said little, seeming to consult and assent among themselves almost in silence. At last the shorter woman looked with her fierce eyes at Medra. Stay if you will, she said. I will. What will you have us call you? Turn, he said, and so he was called. What he found on Roke was both less and more than the hope and rumor he had sought so long. Roke Island was, they told him, the heart of Earthsea. The first land Segoi raised from the waters in the beginning of time was bright Ea of the northern sea, and the second was Roke. That green hill, Roke Knoll, was founded deeper than all the islands. The trees he had seen, which seemed sometimes to be in one place on the isle, and sometimes in another, were the oldest trees in the world, and the source and center of magic. If the grove were cut, all wizardry would fail. The roots of those trees are the roots of knowledge. The patterns the shadows of their leaves make in the sunlight write the words Segoi spoke in the making. So said Ember, his fierce black-browed teacher. All the teachers of the art magic on Roke were women. There were no men of power. Few men at all, on the island. 30 years before, the pirate lords of Wathort had sent a fleet to conquer Roke, not for its wealth, which was little, but to break the power of its magery, which was reputed to be great. One of the wizards of Roke had betrayed the island to the crafty men of Wathort, lowering its spells of defense and warning. Once those were breached, the pirates took the island by death and fire, not by wizardries. Their great ships filled Thwil Bay, their hordes burned and looted, their slave-takers carried off men, boys, young women. Little children and the old they slaughtered. They fired every house and field they came to. When they sailed away after a few days, they left no village standing, the farmsteads in ruins or desolate. The town at the bay's head, Thwill, shared something of the uncanniness of the knoll and the grove. For though the raiders had run through it seeking slaves and plunder and setting fires, the fires had gone out and the narrow streets had sent them astray. Most of the islanders who survived were wise women and their children, who had hidden themselves in the town or in the imminent grove. The men now on Roke were those spared children, grown, and a few men now grown old. There was no government but that of the women of the hand, for it was their spells that had protected Roke so long, and protected it far more closely now. They had little trust in men. A man had betrayed them. Men had attacked them. It was men's ambitions, they said, that had perverted all the arts to ends of gain. "We do not deal with their governments," said Tall Vale in her mild voice. Yet Ember said to Medra, "We were our own undoing." The women of the hand had joined together on Roke 100 or more years ago, forming a league of mages. Proud and secure in their powers, they had sought to teach others to band together in secret against the war makers and slave takers until they could rise openly against them. Women had gone from Roke to other lands around the inmost sea, weaving a wide, fine net of resistance. Even now there were strands and knots of that net left. Medra had come on one of them first in Anyeb's village and had followed them since, but they had not let him hear. Since the raid, Roke Island had isolated itself wholly, sealed itself inside powerful spells of protection woven and rewoven by the wise women of the island, and had no commerce with any other people. "We can't save them," Ember said. "We couldn't save ourselves." Vale, with her gentle voice and smile, was implacable. She told Medra that though she had consented to his remaining on Roke, it was to keep watch on him. "You broke through our defenses once," she said. "All that you say of yourself may be true and may not. What can you tell me that would make me trust you?" She agreed with the others to give him a little house down by the harbor and a job helping the boat builder of Thwill, who had taught herself her trade and welcomed his skill. She put no difficulties in his path and always greeted him kindly. But she had said, "What can you tell me that would make me trust you?" And he had no answer for her. Ember usually scowled when he greeted her. She asked him abrupt questions, listened to his answers, and said nothing. He asked her, rather timidly, a question about the imminent grove, for when he had asked others, they said, "Ember can tell you." She refused his question. Not arrogantly, but definitely, saying, "You can learn about the grove only in it and from it." One afternoon, she came down to the sands of Thwill Bay, where he was repairing a fishing boat. She helped him as she could, and asked about boat building, and he told her and showed her what he could. It was a peaceful afternoon, but after it, she went off in her abrupt way. He felt some awe of her. She was incalculable. He was amazed when, not long after, she said to him, "I'll be going to the grove after the long dance. Come if you like." Though it seemed that from Roke Knoll the whole extent of the grove could be seen, yet if you walked in it, you did not always come out into the fields again. You walked on under the trees, oak and beech and ash, chestnut and walnut and willow, familiar trees, green in spring and bare in winter. There were dark firs and a tall evergreen Medra did not know, with soft reddish bark and layered foliage. You walked on, and the way through the trees was never twice the same. People in Thwill told him it was best not to go too far, since only by returning as you went could you be sure of coming out into the fields. "How far does the forest go?" Medra asked, and Ember said, "As far as the mind goes." "The leaves of the trees spoke," she said, "and the shadows could be read. I am learning to read them," she said. When he was on Oromi, Medra had learned to read the common writing of the archipelago. Later, Hydrake of Pendor had taught him some of the runes of power. That was known lore. What Ember had learned alone in the imminent grove was not known to any but those with whom she shared her knowledge. She lived all summer under the eaves of the grove, having no more than a shelter of branches and a cook fire near a stream that ran from the woods to join the little river running down to the bay. Medra camped nearby. He did not know what Ember wanted of him, evidently to teach him to begin to answer his questions about the grove. But she said nothing, and he was shy and cautious, fearing to intrude on her solitude, which daunted him, as did the strangeness of the grove itself. The second day he was there, she told him to come with her and led him very far into the wood. They walked for hours in silence. In the summer midday, the woods were silent. No bird sang, the leaves did not stir. The aisles of the trees were endlessly different and all the same. He did not know when they turned back, but he knew they had walked farther than the shores of Rook. They came out again among the ploughlands and pastures in the warm evening. As they walked back to their camping place, he saw the four stars of the forge come out above the western hills. Ember parted from him with only a good night. The next day, she said, I'm going to sit under the trees. Not sure what was expected of him, he followed her at a distance, and when she sat down, he sat down. And as she watched and listened and was still, he watched and listened and was still. So they did for several days. Then one morning, rebelling, he stayed by the stream while Ember walked into the grove. She did not look back. Vale came from Thwiltown that morning, bringing them a basket of bread, cheese, milk curds, summer fruits. What have you learned? She asked Medra in her cool, gentle way, and he said, That I'm a fool. Why so, Tern? A fool could sit under the trees forever and grow no wiser. The tall woman smiled a little. My sister has never taught a man before, she said. She glanced at him and gazed away, over the summery fields. She's never looked at a man before, she said. Medra stood silent. His face felt very hot. He looked down. I thought, he said, and stopped. In Vale's words he saw, all at once, the other side of Ember's impatience, her fierceness, her silences. He had tried to look at Ember as untouchable while he longed to touch her soft brown skin, her black shining hair. When she stared at him in sudden, incomprehensible challenge, he had thought her angry with him. He feared to insult, to offend her. What did she fear? His desire? Her own? But she was not an inexperienced girl. She was a wise woman, a mage, she who walked in the imminent grove and understood the patterns of the shadows. All this went rushing through his mind like a flood breaking through a dam while he stood at the edge of the woods with Vale. I thought mages kept themselves apart, he said at last. Hydrake said that to make love is to unmake power. So some wise men say, said Vale mildly. And smiled again, and bade him goodbye. He spent the whole afternoon in confusion, angry. When Ember came out of the grove to her leafy bower upstream, he went there, carrying Vale's basket as an excuse. May I talk to you? He said. She nodded shortly, frowning her black brows. He said nothing. She squatted down to find out what was in the basket. Peaches, she said. And smiled. My master Hydrake said that wizards who make love unmake their power, he blurted out. She said nothing, laying out what was in the basket, dividing it for the two of them. Do you think that's true? He said. She shrugged. No, she said. He stood tongue-tied. After a while, she looked up at him. No. She said in a soft, quiet voice. I don't think it's true. I think all the true powers, all the old powers, at root are one. He still stood there. And she said, Look at the peaches. They're all ripe. We'll have to eat them right away. If I told you my name, he said, my true name, I tell you mine, she said. If that's how we should begin. They began, however, with the peaches. They were both shy. When Medra took her hand, his hand shook, and Ember, whose name was Elial, turned away scowling. Then she touched his hand, very lightly. When he stroked the sleek black flow of her hair, she seemed only to endure his touch, and he stopped. When he tried to embrace her, she was stiff, rejecting him. Then she turned, and fierce, hasty, awkward, took him in her arms. It wasn't the first night, nor the first nights, they passed together that gave either of them much pleasure or ease. But they learned from each other, and came through shame and fear into passion. Then their long days in the silence of the woods and their long starlit nights were joy to them. When Vale came up from town to bring them the last of the late peaches, they laughed. Peaches were the very emblem of their happiness. They tried to make her stay and eat supper with them, but she would not. "Stay here while you can," she said. The summer ended too soon that year. Rain came early. Snow fell in early autumn, even as far south as Roque. Storm followed storm, as if the winds had risen in rage against the tampering meddling of the crafty men. Women sat together by the fire in the lonely farmhouses. People gathered around the hearths in Thwiltown. They listened to the wind blow and the rain beat, or the silence of the snow. Outside Thwill Bay, the sea thundered on the reefs and on the cliffs around the shores of the island, a sea no boat could venture out in. What they had, they shared. In that, it was indeed Morred's Isle. Nobody on Roque starved or went unhoused, though nobody had much more than they needed. Hidden from the rest of the world, not only by sea and storm, but by their defenses that disguised the island and sent ships astray, they worked and talked and sang the songs, the Winter Carol and the Deed of the Young King. And they had books, the Chronicles of Enlad and the History of the Wise Heroes. From these precious books, the old men and women would read aloud in a hall down by the wharf where the fisherwomen made and mended their nets. There was a hearth there, and they would light the fire. People came even from farms across the island to hear the histories read, listening in silence, intent. "Our souls are hungry," Ember said. She lived with Medra in his small house not far from the net house, though she spent many days with their sister Vale. Ember and Vale had been little children on a farm near Thwill when the raiders came from Wathort. Their mother hid them in a root cellar on the farm, and then used her spells to try to defend her husband and brothers, who would not hide but fought the raiders. They were butchered with their cattle. The house and barns were burnt. The little girls had stayed in the root cellar that night and the nights after. Neighbors who came at last to bury the rotting bodies of the cattle found the two children, silent, starving, armed with a mattock and a broken plowshare, ready to defend the heaps of stones and earth they had piled over their dead. Medra knew only a hint of this story from Ember. One night, Vale, who was 3 years older than Ember, and to whom the memory was much clearer, told it to him fully. Ember sat with them, listening in silence. In return, he told Vale and Ember about the mines of Samore, and the wizard Gelluk, and Anyeb the slave. When he was done, Vale was silent a long time, and then said, "That was what you meant when you came here first. I could not save the one who saved me. And you asked me, 'What can you tell me that could make me trust you?' You have told me," Vale said. Medra took her hand and put his forehead against it. Telling his story, he had kept back tears. He could not do so now. "She gave me freedom," he said, "and I still feel that all I do is done through her and for her. No, not for her. We can do nothing for the dead, but for us," said Ember. "For us who live, in hiding, neither killed nor killing. The dead are dead. The great and mighty go their way unchecked, All the hope left in the world is in the people of no account. Must we hide forever? Spoken like a man, said Vale with her gentle, wounded smile. Yes, said Ember, we must hide, and forever if need be, because there's nothing left but being killed and killing beyond these shores. You say it, and I believe it. But you can't hide true power, Medra said, not for long. It dies in hiding, unshared. Magic won't die on Roke, said Vale. On Roke all spells are strong. So said Ath himself. And you have walked under the trees. Our job must be to keep that strength. Hide it, yes, hoard it, as a young dragon hoards up its fire, and share it, but only here. Pass it on, one to the next, here, where it's safe, and where the great robbers and killers would least look for it, since no one here is of any account. And one day, the dragon will come into its strength, if it takes 1,000 years. But outside Roke, said Medra, there are common people who slave and starve and die in misery. Must they do so for 1,000 years with no hope? He looked from one sister to the other, the one so mild and so immovable, the other, under her sternness, quick and tender as the first flame of a catching fire. On Havnor, he said, far from Roke, in a village on Mount On, among people who know nothing of the world. Yet there are still women of the hand. That net hasn't broken after so many years. How was it woven? Craftily, said Ember, and cast wide. He looked from one to the other again. I wasn't well taught in the city of Havnor, he said. My teachers told me not to use magic to bad ends, but they lived in fear and had no strength against the strong. They gave me all they had to give, but it was little. It was by luck I didn't go wrong, and by Anyeb's gift of strength to me. But for her, I'd be Gellick's servant now. Yet she herself was untaught, and so enslaved. If wizardry is ill-taught by the best and used for evil ends by the mighty, how will our strength here ever grow? What will the young dragon feed on? This is the center, said Vale. We must keep to the center and wait. We must give what we have to give, said Medra. If all but us are slaves, what's our freedom worth? The true art prevails over the false. The pattern will hold, Ember said, frowning. She reached out the poker to gather together her namesakes in the hearth, and with a whack knocked the heap into a blaze. That I know. But our lives are short, and the pattern's very long. If only Roke was now what it once was, if we had more people of the true art gathered here, teaching and learning as well as preserving. If Roke was now what it once was, known to be strong, those who fear us would come again to destroy us, said Vale. The secret lies in secrecy, said Medra. But so does the problem. Our problem is with men, Vale said, if you'll forgive me, dear brother. Men are of more account to other men than women and children are. We might have 50 witches here, and they'll pay little heed. But if they knew we had 5 men of power, they'd seek to destroy us again. So though there were men among us, we were the women of the hand, said Ember. You still are, Medra said. Anyeb was one of you. She and you and all of us live in the same prison. What can we do? Said Vale. Learn our strength, said Medra. A school, Ember said, where the wise might come to learn from one another to study the pattern. The grove would shelter us. The lords of war despise scholars and schoolmasters, said Medra. I think they fear them too, said Vale. So they talked that long winter, and others talked with them. Slowly their talk turned from vision to intention, from longing to planning. Vale was always cautious, warning of dangers. White-haired Dune was so eager that Ember said he wanted to start teaching sorcery to every child in Thwill. Once Ember had come to believe that Roke's freedom lay in offering others freedom, she set her whole mind on how the women of the hand might grow strong again. But her mind, formed by her long solitudes among the trees, always sought form and clarity, and she said, How can we teach our art when we don't know what it is? And they talked about that, all the wise women of the island. What was the true art of magic, and where did it turn false? How the balance of things was kept or lost? What crafts were needful, which useful, which dangerous? Why some people had one gift but not another, and whether you could learn an art you had no native gift for? In such discussions, they worked out the names that ever since have been given to the masteries: finding, weatherworking, changing, healing, summoning, patterning, naming, and the crafts of illusion and the knowledge of the songs. Those are the arts of the masters of Roke even now, though the chanter took the finder's place when finding came to be considered a merely useful craft, unworthy of a mage. And so it was in these discussions that the school on Roke began. There are some who say that the school had its beginnings far differently. They say that Roke used to be ruled by a woman called the Dark Woman, who was in league with the old powers of the earth. They say she lived in a cave under Roke Knoll, never coming into the daylight, but weaving vast spells over land and sea that compelled men to her evil will, until the first archmage came to Roke, unsealed and entered the cave, defeated the Dark Woman, and took her place. There's no truth in this tale but one, which is that indeed one of the first masters of Roke opened and entered a great cavern, but that cavern was not on Roke, though the roots of Roke are the roots of all the islands. And it's true that in the time of Medra and Elial, the people of Roke, men and women, had no fear of the old powers of the earth, but revered them, seeking strength and vision from them. But that changed with the years that came after. Spring came late again that year, cold and stormy. Medra set to bolt building. By the time the peaches flowered, he had made a slender, sturdy, deep-sea fishing boat, built according to the style of Havnor. He called her Hopeful. Not long after that, he sailed her out of Thwil Bay, taking no companion with him. "Look for me at the end of summer," he said to Ember. "I'll be in the grove," she said, "and my heart with you, my dark otter, my white tern, my love, Medra. And mine with you, my ember of fire, my flowering tree, my love, Elial."